Hey everybody, welcome back to the Badgerland Birding Podcast, bringing you birding news and stories from the Badger State and beyond. Today we're super excited to be talking with Alex Lamro, guide for Wildside Nature Tours. He's coming at us from Maine today. How are you doing, Alex?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
Doing well. We've hit a
Coming at
little
you from the big eBird blackout of 2024 here. Driving me crazy.
Yeah, we need to give the people some media since eBird is down, but can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in guiding and kind of what you do now?
Throughout, well, I've done a bird work and I've been a birder my whole life, and starting in like middle school, high school, I started helping with field work, bird field work around the country. And then every year during every summer in college, just moving out west to do bird work out there. And then I kept doing that for about 10 years. And I've always really wanted to get into guiding. I started going to a lot of the birding festivals or organizing small tours on my own. And then in 2016, I got hired on by Wildside to help with our Big Year Tour series, which Chris Brown and I lead our big year schedule around the United States. And that's kind of where it's at now. Just got back from Arizona. Guess our fourth big year tour of the year.
Awesome. You guys were there for the hawk migration stuff, right?
Yeah, the So our big year tours are broken up into like there's like 8 or 10 4 or 5 day short tours, and then the others are Saturday or Sunday to Saturday, like week long, or there's a couple longer ones. So this was just a short tour to Arizona Monday through Friday to capture this common blackhawk migration, because there's this really narrow window when all the common blackhawks that were wintering in like western Mexico, they flow up through Southeast Arizona to like return to their breeding locations in cottonwood riparian forests in mostly Arizona and Utah, New Mexico. So it's just very reliable. I love migration, and being able to take a tour group on a migration focused tour is really difficult because so many things are unpredictable with weather. But March in Arizona, the weather is just like 75 degrees every day, light south wind, and like it's just very reliable, and the Blackhawks come through in that window perfectly. So yeah, the tour focuses on the hawks, and then just any little jaunts we can do for other Southeast Arizona specialties nearby. So fun, relaxing, like spring trip, gets you into the zone for spring migration.
Sweet. I will say how I first kind of got to know you, Alex, is I would see your eBird checklist or your reports. I'd be like, man, that guy went there and he saw everything that you would hope to see in that specific region. So I imagine, people that get on tours with you, they're pretty pleased with how you guys normally do. Was being a guide something you always wanted to do, or was it just kind of like fell into your lap and, man, this is pretty cool. Let's do this as a career?
It was in the back of my mind. I always wanted to do bird research, and I still love that, and I still try to do that in my gaps between tours. But ultimately, I started to realize that I just love like the excitement of birding with people and showing people birds, and the hunt of like today we're focusing on these targets and we're gonna go out and try to find them, and working with birders as a group, and so kind of just like happened naturally, shifting into being a guide full time, I think. And I my timing was just lucky that I was able to join the Wildside crew and take on the Big Year series that we've got now.
So these big year tours, are they specifically for people that want to see everything in the United States, or what's the big picture behind them? Like, do people do all of them usually then? If they go on one, they do all of them, or how does it work?
Well, yeah, with the help of Greg Miller, who was in the movie The Big Year, Jack Black played Greg, and I'm sure a lot of people listening know Greg, but he helped us just crunch the numbers on eBird sightings and really lock in the like ultimate peak window to visit each core region of the United States and sort of patch together this big year route. And so definitely it's on a tight schedule. Each tour is like usually about just 7 days, 5 real full days of birding. So we go around and after particular regional specialties and targets. And of course, like when rarities pop up, we have to like veer off course and get those too, which can be good and bad, but usually works out. So yeah, a lot of people have really liked the style and the pace, and had a lot of big year birders jump on for a tour here and there to help them out with their year, or people kind of go on one tour 1 year, two or three tours the next year, two tours the next year, and kind of patch together getting the birds of the United States over the course of multiple years.
So with you guys running this big year tour series, I'm going to hit you with a pretty loaded question. What do you think the top five places to bird in the United States are? Like if someone's new and they're like, I'm going to five places, I want to see the coolest spots, which five are you telling them to go to?
Right off the bat, I love South Padre Island and the Rio Grande Valley, so I would say that is absolutely top five. If you can hit South Padre and the Texas coast and then Rio Grande Valley in late April, early May, that's like the best birding in the country. Just migrants, regional specialties, just has everything going on. Arizona, where I just was, I do my March short tour for the Blackhawks, and then Chris and I have an August tour for like the full Southeast Arizona loop. And beyond that, trip is so great because you have so many specialty birds, plus all the mammals and night driving for reptiles and amphibians, and butterflies during the daytime. It's just like the total wildlife package in the lower 48, I think, is it's just the ultimate spot for that. And then I really love Central California and Southern California. So I lean towards the western states, and I would say Texas, Arizona, California, Washington. They're my core places I love to go. Now I live in Maine, so I guess I should plug the Maine trip too, which it's great too, and has a lot of specialty birds, spruce grouse and bicknell thrush. So
I was gonna ask, what are some of the best birds to get on, I guess, the New England side of the country? So some of the stuff you can't really get anywhere else. You know, you mentioned Bicknell's thrush as one. What are some of the other things that people go out that way to get?
during the breeding season, Bicknell's thrush and Atlantic puffin and spruce grouse is getting much harder to find. It's probably now better, well, in Alaska on our Alaska trip, and then hoping to see one out in one of our Rocky Mountain trips. But unfortunately, they're declining. But then we have a short tour in the wintertime, which is when New England like really shines, I think, because from land you can see dovekie and thick-billed murre, razor bills, fulmar, kittiwake. So some of those kind of North Atlantic seabirds, I think, are good. And then fall migration on the East Coast at Cape May is just amazing, and it's world famous for that.
Yeah, I've heard really good things about the Cape May Festival, but I've never been there. I'm assuming you would recommend that as a place to go.
Yeah, the festival is sort of, I think it's always the weekend before Halloween weekend or however that works out, and it can be a little late in the season for a lot of the songbird diversity. You're kind of just in like the swarms of yellow rumps time of the year then, but you start to see a lot of the water bird migration, which is really underappreciated in Cape May, and late season raptors too, golden eagles. So it's a good window, and just Cape May has the best like small beach town vibes. It's just a great place.
Yeah, it sounds like a really cool festival. And they do a spring one as well, right? Yeah.
For kind of more focused on the red knot migration, and there's actually a pretty decent spring migration that happens in Cape May. People think it only works like as a funnel of southbound birds, but they get great birds in the spring too.
Are there any parts of the US that you haven't been to yet?
Well, Arkansas, it's a sad hole in the middle of my eBird map there. I've only been
Yeah,
to
just take a
Arkansas.
trip.
I know. I've only somehow been through Arkansas at night, and I've like stopped to get gas and tried calling for screech owl and barred owl and like got nothing. So I'm not exactly eager to get to Arkansas, but I do want to fill that in.
I feel like when you do, you have to go big though. Like, you can't just go to Arkansas and check a few birds off. You have to like big days for a week in Arkansas and see if you can really fill that bad boy up.
Alex's Arkansas tour is open if people want to join him for a 20-day trip or something.
I think it might come down to that, but we'll see.
Well, thankfully, with the eBird blackout, you won't have to look at your map for a couple of days. So that should
That's
take a little
true. That's
pressure off.
true.
Yeah, just a little bit. As somebody that's gone all over the country looking for different bird species, I have two questions for you based on that. What is your all-time favorite bird that you've seen in the United States? Whether it's one that actually lives here, whether it was rare from some other country, and then what is the one that you want to see next?
Well, I gotta give a shout out to red-tailed hawk. Everybody that knows me knows it's just my favorite bird, the bird that got me into birding, and such a reliable, like every single one of my tours, even to other countries, you in North America, Central America, you see red-tailed hawks, and each one is different. And I think it's, I just love getting photos of them and learning about the regional variation. So underappreciated red-tailed hawk. It's really a number one for me. But on like an annual, my annual schedule of tours, the things I most look forward to, California condor in Central California is just an incredible bird, iconic of America, and a success story. Next thing looking forward to, well, I've got my spring trips coming up. Always look forward to seeing a golden-cheeked warbler, black capybara, things like that.
A little trip to Texas for that one, I'm betting. Yeah.
Hill country, yep.
Has there been a
And
time on? Oh, go ahead, Alex.
oh well, the unexpected like rarities that pop up always, like, oh, I had my Minnesota winter boreal specialties tour this year, and we were like, it was like a day or two before the trip, or maybe even the first day I got to Minnesota, and you guys in Wisconsin had the field fair. So like I had two boreal winter boreal specialties tours to Minnesota back to back, and at the final day of each tour, we like shot over from Duluth and got the field fair for the tour group and went back. So like totally off the wall, unexpected. It was a lifer for me, and I got to get it with tour group, so that's like what makes birding so much fun, and also goes back to like how we've kind of scheduled these tours to various regions when during the peak season when there is that potential, you just got to be there and right place, right time. So
I was going to say too, how dare you not mention the Midwest when you're going over the best places to go birding in the US? I was like, come on, Alex, give us a shout out to Sac Zim or the Lake Michigan coastline or something.
no, totally. The Great Lakes has some great birding and really underappreciated migration spectacles, and Duluth actually is one of my favorite cities. I got to live there when I worked at Hawk Ridge for a couple of years, and I love going back every winter for the trip.
You have
Oh,
very much
sure it is, Alex.
a Duluth vibe, I feel like, with the beard. You fit right
Yeah.
in with the breweries and stuff there.
He actually kind of looks like the Duluth Trading Company guy. In the commercials, he's kind of got the Duluth Trading Company vibe going. So maybe he is telling the truth.
Yeah, a little additional income there for you if you want to hop on that. Has there ever been a tour where you were leading a group and there was a rare bird reported you really wanted to go see, but they just did not want to see it, and it was tough because you wanted to see it, but you couldn't go and get it?
Everybody's usually on board. I have like weird goals though. Like going back to South Padre Island right now, there's a downy woodpecker there. And if I were leading a tour there, it's like the first downy woodpecker for like the Texas coast, like south of like Houston. And I love South Padre Island, and I love like patch birding on the island. So if I were leading a tour right there, I'd be like, guys, today we should go to South Padre Island, I think, and try to get that downy woodpecker just, and nobody would care at all, but as far as like true rarities go, like the field fair, everybody was like, oh yeah, oh yeah, hour and a half away, we're going for this. So and that's the thing about tours, like I feel like everybody in the group is a participant, because birding, like I can put us in good places at the right time, and there's some luck involved, and then you need the birds to cooperate, but having the full group on board and like everybody looking, it's really exciting, really fun. And that's what I really enjoy about guiding, just like the team effort it takes.
Yeah, there's something special it feels like about showing someone else a bird, because I feel like, when you've seen them in a specific area a lot of times, you don't necessarily lose the enjoyment out of it, but it kind of refuels your enjoyment again when you can see someone else super pumped up about that downy woodpecker that's on South Padre Island. And it's not just you enjoying it. There's something special about that.
No, totally. And yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Is there a specific tour that you've done where you're just like, man, we nailed it? Like, we got everything we wanted to, plus, X rare species, or one that just really stands out in your mind?
Well, there were some very exciting things that happened last November on our Rio Grande tour right after the
Oh,
festival,
yeah.
because the tiger, were you guys there for the tiger heron?
So I was on the tour that found the tiger heron.
Oh yeah, that's amazing. And then my tour started that Sunday, and so I worked it out with Ryan that we like went into the ranch on Monday or Tuesday, I forget, but we spent most of the afternoon there, and the night heron came flying past us. So that was like a, and then there were so many other just great rarities staked out, and I think we ended up with our highest fall tour list ever last year. So the tiger heron got us on a great trajectory there, and we just really had a great week.
Did you then go up and get the cattle tyrant too?
Yeah. Actually, that maybe that's how it worked. The very first day we drove up, I got everybody. We drove up and did this great loop with the cattle tyrant. Whooping cranes were right there. There was a bar-tailed godwit there. And then went out to Aransas for the Aplomato falcon and flamingo combo that, and then came back down. Then the next day we went to the ranch. So those are all just spur of the minute things that like the cattle tyrant was found the first day, that Sunday, first day of the tour. And the tiger heron was found just a few days before. So like I didn't plan for that at all. They just like fell into our lap, and then we changed up the schedule and went after them. That the nice thing about our two Rio Grande tours is we're just based in one hotel for the whole week and like do day trips. So when rarities pop up, we're really flexible with shifting days around.
Yeah, that's neat. Do you ever get burnt out leading tours? Or do you feel like you always just have the energy to go do it?
I have a lot of energy to go and do it. I do love birding, and every year, even though Chris Brown and I do the same schedule, we like have honed it in. And going back to what we were saying earlier, sometimes birds can be a real pain if you're a guide because like, oh, we've seen this bird here 4 years in a row, and no, this year it's not here. Like, what the heck? But I'm gone about between birding tours and festivals, I'm gone like 200 days a year, and then I do office work type things in my own birding when I'm home. So far not burnt out. Really enjoying it.
Because I know some people I've talked to who've done big years, and some of them are like, man, I just, at the end, I didn't have the energy to go do it, but I went to look for it anyways. And other people are like, yeah, every day I got to see a cool rare bird. So I feel like it's kind of a person, a person by person basis of how they feel about birding all the time.
Flying on airplanes really gets to me, but I'm not totally over it yet.
It was funny because we talked with Arjan Dwarshuis about his global big year, and he didn't have a single flight cancellation or any issues with the airports. And I was like, that in itself feels like a once in a lifetime opportunity to not have that for a year.
Yeah, geez. And probably some of those were made, plans were made like last minute and they worked out. But yeah, I've been pretty lucky with that too. But I know when to avoid, like, don't go to Chicago certain times of the year.
Just
Don't go
ever.
through.
Just don't do
Yeah.
that.
Don't
Don't.
ever go to Chicago. That backfired on some of our participants on the Arizona tour because they were like flying home. They were like, no, I shouldn't go through Chicago. There could still be a winter storm. So they decided to go through Denver, but then Denver had this like insane snowstorm. So you never know.
Do you have any tips for younger birders that want to make birding their career? Because I feel like two of the main paths right now, if you're birding being a career, is either you do research or you end up being a tour guide.
Well, I mean, the social component is so huge, and then the knowledge base of birds is so big too. So you got to find a balance there. I would say that you just one big thing is get involved with like your local birding group and get out birding with people, different people. And if you have a birding festival nearby, ask if you can be a co-leader on a trip or just to go on a trip to like see how the guides lead and get some tips from that and just watch how it works. And then like I was saying, learning the birds. Like you could be a regional tour guide, which a lot of people do. They lead tours, day trips, and things to where they live, and that's great. If you want to do more nationwide or international things, then I really recommend doing field work for, a month here, 2 months there, and really kind of dive deep in these regions and get to be familiar with them, because you need to be able to make spontaneous choices on where to look for birds if birds aren't cooperating, or where to get lunch, where bathroom is. So you need the on the ground time spent there.
Is there something that you feel when you're leading a tour is your main specialty, whether it's, song ID or just knowing the lay
Making
of the
sure
land?
because I know where all the bathrooms are, know where you can get the best sandwich in Puerto Rico.
Honestly, the bathroom thing is like a key. You need to know when to make those bathroom stops and everything.
Jokingly, I'd say making the eBird checklist, because I'm obsessed with that. I make like hundreds per tour, but I don't know, having a deep connection with the birds and having a lot of friends in places around the country that I can rely on for intel has really helped me out and made a lot of successful trips happen.
Cool. What's your favorite place to go outside of the US?
More and more Mexico, and I really would like to see all the endemic birds of Mexico and the different regions of Mexico, so slowly chipping away at that. But yeah, anywhere in the tropics is just amazing for the just overload of birds and other wildlife. But any place I can go and see active migration, like being in one spot and having birds just flow past you and you don't know what's coming next, that's my favorite kind of bird watching.
That definitely is very exciting. I need you to clear something up for us. Is Mexico a dangerous place to go birding?
No. I maybe on your own, I wouldn't just start driving around northern Mexico, but everywhere I've been on a birding tour or birding on my own has just been absolutely great and no problem at all.
I like how it started no, and then it was like, well, actually.
With any birding, you got to be smart and do your planning ahead of time and work with local guides or look up who the top 100 birders are and send some messages out there, and you'll be fine. Just prepare.
Have you been to any of these really crazy birding places, such as like Russia or the places where the birds are just so drastically different than they are in North America?
Well, even though it's still attached to North America, earlier this year I was co-leading a trip for Manomet Bird Observatory down to Tierra del Fuego in Argentina and Chile, and there are familiarities, mostly the migratory birds. Like we were there to see shorebirds on the wintering grounds, and so I'm very familiar with like white-rumped sandpiper and Hudsonian godwit. But then those birds leave us and go down there and mix with like this whole cast of totally unusual, insane birds that are so different from what we have in North America, but also like fill these similar roles, or they're like the only members of certain genuses that kind of like fill in the gaps of things that we are familiar with. So it's so eye-opening and gives you this insight into the whole other world of our birds. Really exciting and fun.
Yeah, for sure. I actually, when you were talking about that, I sort of got another question. I want to kind of go back to the beginning for you. How did you get into birding in the first place? Like, how old were you? What sparked it for you? Probably a red-tailed hawk, based on what I've heard already, but.
Well, I'm the only person in my family that's even like outdoorsy nature, other than like hunting when I was a little kid and fishing. But I love the animals, concept of animals, and I just latched on to raptors. Even just riding the bus to school, I would see red tails and kestrels and merlin, and I was like, oh my gosh, these birds are here and live here and peregrines. And so that's what hooked me to start. And then I was really lucky to meet Scott Wydenstahl, an author and biologist, and he invited me to come up to his saw-whet owl banding operation. And he had three or four sites in eastern Pennsylvania where I grew up, and so I got to visit those places and help capture saw-whet owls and screech owls and things. like since I was 8 or 9 years old, all through elementary, middle school, high school, and meet, and that way I got to meet other birders and biologists, and I just love the whole scene and the birds. So I don't know, just happened.
At what point did you realize birding was an actual hobby? Because for the longest time, I had no idea birding was a hobby
Yeah.
until seeing the big year. And then I was like, oh my goodness, people actually do this. It's real. Like, at what point were you like, this isn't just a thing that I do and other people also do this?
It took me a while. Like, yeah, when I was little, I would wander around with binoculars behind our house and find stuff. But and then I thought, like, I would see warblers and field guides, but I could never ever find them in the wild. So I just figured, like, these things must be insanely rare. But I just didn't know, like,
They're extinct.
there were tons of great warblers like within a few miles of my house. I just didn't know the places to go or the times of year that you need to look for these things. So yeah, then I met birders, and then it was a while until I met like birders my own age, and then I was like, okay, this is like other people are doing this, so this is cool.
Yeah, we had that same experience with looking in the field guides because where we live, we have this big forest, the South Kettle Moraine State Forest, and we would see the stuff where the range map was in, Wisconsin. And southern Wisconsin, and we would go out and we'd be like, why isn't any of this stuff here? It's ridiculous that these field guides are just lying to us. And it took a long time to realize, okay, it's here, but it's not here until this time of the year. Okay, it's here, but it's only going to be in this habitat. And once you can get that nailed down, that opened up the door for a lot of different experiences for us, which I don't know, there's a lot of funny basic learning curve stuff that I guess you don't realize or take for granted after a while.
Yeah, for sure. I think of like Sora and Virginia Rail as good examples because people getting into birding, you're like, oh my gosh, a Sora. You see it in the book, you're like, I'm never going to see this thing. But if you go to the right marshes at spring migration, fall migration, or if they breed nearby you, you can easily see a sori. You just need to figure out the pattern. And that's where it's so important to join Audubon groups and local bird groups and like get input from different people and see how people do
Yeah, for us, it was the American coot. We looked in the field guide and we were like, oh, look at this thing. What a crazy animal. I bet we're never going to get to see one of these. And then cut to years later where there's literally thousands of them just floating around in the river in front of us. And we're like, oh, look at all the coots.
Yeah.
All right, I have a question for you. So the technology has drastically changed from, say 20 years ago, and we have a lot of these cool technological advances. There's the backyard bird stuff, like the smart bird feeders, the smart nest boxes, the thermal cameras, and then I saw the Swarovski binoculars that are supposed to ID birds for you. I don't know about those, but what's your favorite technological advancement? Could be something like Merlin or one of the other ones I mentioned. And how do you think that's impacting birding? Is it for the better or for the worse?
Yeah, there's so many things are happening so quickly, and another thing is like I just bought one of these haiku box units that you put in your yard, and it sends you a little notification when a new bird shows up based on similar technology to Merlin, and it's incredible. Like the haiku box tipped me off to some red-shouldered hawks, which I had never seen or heard here, and now I've been home working the past few days, and we've got red-shouldered hawks flying around the yard like courting. So and also I haven't seen a pine siskin in my home county yet this year, but every day the haiku box has been getting like gray recordings of pine siskin, and I keep leaving or being asleep or something. So I think it's better. I think there was like this time where Merlin, the audio Merlin, came out 1 or 2 years ago, and like for the next 3 months on tours, I would look behind me and everybody's just walking around with their phone out. Like it's a little obnoxious because it takes you out of the moment, but at the same time, helps you, beginner birders, it gives you more context, it gives you some confidence in like confirming what you think a bird ID is, and if you have some hearing issues, it can be super helpful. So there's pros and cons, of course. Ultimately, anything to promote birding and get people out there engaging with it is good, and going to be getting better and better as the technology gets better. But yeah, got to take it all with a grain of salt as far as what Merlin spits out at you.
Yeah, I heard there was a thing from Biggest Week where someone had like the phone on their wrist and they had a external mic on their hat And they would just look at Merlin and not even look at the birds, just be like, oh, Cape May Warbler. Oh, this. And they weren't even watching anything going on. So I think that's the far end of what you don't want to
Yeah.
be.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's a risk associated with technology, apparently, to a degree. So that is true. That haiku box sounds awesome, though.
It's pretty great. I just had it here for a couple of days, and there's some errors. You can adjust the confidence level of the AI thing, and it only tells you what it's very sure of. One weird thing is it hasn't really been able to pick up the woodcocks calling, and they're like loud. I don't know what the deal with that is, but there's also this Terra system coming out, and people have made their own like live listening speakers too, which I want to try to make one of those. But
I heard some story about one of those that was placed kind of on the border of, I think it was Kentucky and Tennessee or something like that. And it recorded all these wild nocturnal flight calls that would be first state records for the state. And the states, I think, were arguing about which side it should be in because all of the people that were listers didn't want those on the list for the state that they weren't able to get. So I heard about that a while ago and it caused some sort of controversy, but it's pretty funny to think about. It's also funny to think about how much stuff does fly overhead that we just don't even see or just totally miss because it's pretty constant.
Birds are everywhere, and can easily evade us even if we're birding constantly. So
Do
yeah,
you
for sure.
currently have a nemesis bird? One that's just eluded you? The downy
Slateback
woodpecker, South
gull.
Padre Island.
Yeah, that
Oh,
anything that's been on South Padre that I don't have. No, the slateback gull is like my number one. I've chased them. I've chased like stakeout ones at least 10 or 12 times, and I've like even found some birds in Washington and Alaska that are like kind of slateback like, but nobody wants to pull the trigger on them.
Ladyback
So,
adjacent.
yeah. And so that bird's just driving me insane. At this point, I could have just like bought a ticket and chased one down, but I feel like now I just need to find my own. And last year on our spring Texas tour, have you guys been to the Brownsville landfill there?
Oh
Sure
yeah.
have. We went there. There were no Tamaulipas crows, but it's still a sight to see, all the gulls and caracaras and other things. So we went there on the trip and pulled up on top of the landfill, and I looked over and there was this huge dark mantled gull, and I was like, did I just find a slip my own slateback gull? But I brought my binos up onto it. It was a kelp gull, which is like
That's
way
wild.
more rare, like from South America. And the very few records for the United States, but I was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. But like, of course I couldn't just find a slateback gull. I found a kelp gull. So
You're like, stupid bird. Couldn't you just be a slatyback gull?
So that's my nemesis for sure.
We've got a couple of them under our belt, not to brag or anything, but
You
I
guys
live
are
one
the
time in
good.
the Midwest.
Yeah, you guys, the Great Lakes are the go-to.
I'm just waiting for the tour announcement, like, Slatyback Gull tour with Alex Lamro. We're going to spend a month, and if we don't find one, we're going to keep going.
Yeah.
Have you ever done something like that before where you just wanted to see a bird? So you're like, I'm going to have some tours available to this place. Like, oh, I want to go see the grouse out west. And you're like, tours out west, grouse, to kind of like
Yeah.
fund
No.
your personal expedition.
Honestly, yeah, like I do a Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire tour every year. But then did you guys hear about this red-billed tropic bird named Troppy?
No.
I don't think so.
Well, red-billed tropic bird is only like in the South Pacific and what and or sorry, South Atlantic and Pacific. But for like 15 years, this red-billed tropic bird came back to a puffin colony off the coast of Maine and like would float around with a white and red lobster buoy. And after a while, I was like, all right, enough is enough with this. Like next year, I'm gonna schedule a short tour after my Maine tour, and if people want to stay on, we'll like go chase down this tropic bird. And so we did. And of course, the 2 days we were out there were the 2 days it wasn't seen like that week. And then it didn't, and then it died presumably and didn't come back the next year. So I never got to see it.
Oh man.
Dang. Did you
So
see
yeah,
the
I've
buoy and
some
you
of
were like,
those
there's
things.
the partner of the tropic bird?
Yeah.
Maybe people
I
with
have
bad
pictures of
vision
the
could
buoy, like,
count.
oh yeah. Can't always rely on birds, but you gotta give it a shot.
That's true. Okay, I have an off the wall question for you that we ask everyone. You've spent a lot of time outdoors, obviously, probably in the woods, probably in interesting places. Have you ever experienced any weird or paranormal activity in the woods?
The weirdest thing I've seen recently was one unsettling thing I saw recently was we were on my Oregon tour, like out looking for owls at night, and the big like Starlink train of satellites went over.
Oh, yeah.
I was like not prepared for, and you're like out in the middle of like Oregon wilderness, like no light pollution, just beautiful sky. And then to see this train of satellites, like, 15 of them, that like kind of got to me in like, oh my gosh, we've not only taken over the earth, we've like taken over space. But I don't know. Otherwise, still no Bigfoot. Chris and I are looking every day.
Bigfoot tour.
Yeah. But yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, we're always asking people if they've seen Bigfoot or something like that. And usually everyone has some story about some weird, unsettling thing that they've encountered in the woods. But hopefully someday someone's like, yeah, and I got some proof here. And then we can just, blow the lid off that whole thing. So we're waiting for the day.
I'm surprised there hasn't been any bad AI, well, I guess good AI stuff of that, or endangered birds or something like that coming out.
Oh my gosh, that's coming for sure.
It's
That's gonna
got
be
to.
brutal. Yeah.
You're gonna get some ivory-billed woodpecker proof pretty soon. I think that's going to really confuse a lot of people.
Well,
I was thinking
gotta
about the haiku box type deals, and I feel like it'd be neat to place those in some of those forests people don't normally go and just see what's kind of hanging out there. Like, the old
Oh,
areas where they thought imperial woodpeckers could still be and stuff like that.
yeah. Yep. I think Cornell, I mean, there was the motivation to get Merlin out for birding users, but they're going to be putting out a lot of those automated box systems all over the world. It's going to be really amazing.
Maybe we'll end up with like there's no more mystery left in the world anymore. Like they did the DNA test on Loch Ness and they found there was no prehistoric animals living in there or something. I hope that doesn't happen where we're like we got all the evidence and there's no more birds that we thought were still out there. I kind of like to keep the mystery alive.
Oh yeah, there's still so much to learn. I mean, new birds and are found almost every year, and then subspecies or forgotten things that get elevated to species status. We've got a lot to learn, but yeah, the world gets smaller and smaller every day as far as technology goes.
Yeah.
So
Speaking in the subspecies thing, what is a subspecies that you think should be its own species? And then what are two species that you think should be lumped?
well, the Willets need to be split. I've been on that for a long time. Like, there's like the East Coast breeding Willet that's smaller and breeds in the salt marshes. Then it leaves the United States by like first week of August and goes to Brazil and Northern South America for the wintertime. Then there's the Western Willet that breeds throughout the Great Plains and migrates to our coasts for the wintertime and pretty much stays in North America. And that one's bigger, more godwit-like. And to me, it's been long overdue that Eastern and Western Willet get split. And speaking of splits, I'm really nervous about this red-shouldered hawk. Did you hear about like potentially splitting the California red-shouldered hawk, calling it rufous-bellied hawk or something?
No, I haven't
No,
heard about that one. You got all
I
the
just,
inside knowledge.
oh my gosh, I just don't really like that name. I think we should just call it California red-shouldered hawk and like Eastern red-shouldered hawk, or just leave it alone and just leave it be red-shouldered hawk.
I just like how that sentence started. I'm really concerned about the potential red-shouldered hawk split. Like, that's a great birder statement. Like, I am concerned about this red-shouldered hawk thing going on right now.
it impacts my life. I see both kinds, and I care a lot about them. But yeah. And then one lump that I think was legitimate but kind of bothered me was the Cordilleran and Pacific slip flycatcher, because last fall in Cape May we caught a Pacific slip flycatcher, and like it the measurements came out right and the calls were right, and like the precedence for it to be a Pacific slip was good. And we took fecal and tail samples of it and sent them to get tested. But before I could hear back about If it was Pacific Slope or Cordillera, and then they lumped them into one, and so it didn't even matter. Like, it's just Western flycatcher. So turns out it was a Pacific Slope, but doesn't matter. So a lot of work for nothing, really. Sometimes that's very disappointing to clients too, because like someone came on the Oregon tour last year, really wanted to see Pacific Slope, and she got to see it, but I had to break the news to her, like, like a week ago, they actually just made this Western flycatcher. So
You're like,
he
add
already
it to
had
your
Cordillera,
subspecies
sorry.
list.
Yeah.
I think it's funny too, because people that want some significant bird to be, like number 500 or number 600, or number 400, it's probably going to end up being a totally different thing because of all the lumps and splits that are going to happen. So it's like that your 600th bird or your 400th bird is constantly going to be switching between different species, which is kind of funny.
So as like a guy that loves research, if you could get funding to take a month and go into wherever you wanted in the world and do research on one type of bird, which one would you pick?
The freeways and do
I
red
love
tailed hawk.
red-tailed hawk. Yeah, red-tailed hawks of Arkansas.
Yeah, that's the one.
I really want to spend. I love raptors. I love shorebirds, and so some of these really rare, weird shorebirds of South America, I'd love to spend more time with them, and raptors over in Africa. If I could go to Africa for like a month and just like learn all the raptors, spend time just delving into that, that would be really awesome.
Sweet. So with the tours that you guys do, how can people get in touch if they want to do a tour with you guys?
All of our tours are up on the Wildside Nature Tours schedule. A lot of good details there, a lot of past trip reports you can look through to get a sense of it. You might see me out birding, or you might see me at the birding festivals. I gotta go to a lot of the birding festivals and lead trips. And we do offer private versions of our tour. Especially we do private group tours for like if an Audubon society or local bird chapter wants to do their own version of one of our tours, just message me or contact Wildside office and we can get that sorted out. So open to a lot, and yeah, hope to get out birding with people.
For sure. Do you have a favorite festival that you get to go to?
There's something about the biggest week, just all the people and the point blank views of warblers. It's great. But the Fall Rio Grande Valley Festival is really my favorite one. It's just a great time of year. Great people come there. Great guides, really well organized. And then on the more small scale tours, festivals rather, the Acadia Birding Festival in Maine is a great small tour in Bar Harbor, really amazing little town. And also the North Shore Birding Festival, which is in Florida, promoting a Lake Apopka, which is a huge wintering site for tons and tons of water birds. That's a great tour where you get to go into special areas that the general public's not allowed into.
Sweet. Ryan, do you have any other questions for Alex?
I don't think so, but this has been very informative, and I've been very excited to hear about all your adventures and what the birding scene is like on the East Coast.
Great, thanks guys, and hopefully I'll see you around. Are you coming to any festivals coming up?
So we should be at the first part of Biggest Week this year.
All right, well, I'll probably see you there.
Yeah, I'm super pumped about it. All right, well, thanks so much for watching and listening to this episode of the Badgerland Birding Podcast.